This is Lecture 3 in the series, A Theory of Productive Activity, Profit, and Saving. Well, good morning once again, ladies and gentlemen. To those of you who may be wondering, let me say I have not forgotten about productive expenditure and consumption expenditure. They're simmering slowly on the back burner, and we'll get back to them, if not by the end of today's lecture, certainly by Monday's. So far, as I hold it, in the first lecture I showed you the problems prevailing with respect to the concept of productive activity, the tremendous ignorance that exists that in effect rules out half of the operations of a capitalist economy, regards them as unproductive. What I think I established last Monday was to show that money-making is an essential element of productive activity in the context of a division of labor society, in the economic context of a division of labor society, that it distinguishes between capital goods, it determines the distinction between capital goods and consumers' goods, producers' labor and consumers' labor, similarly with loans, and of course, the two fundamental types of expenditure. That framework will be of immense importance when I come to present my own theory of profit, the first application of which will be my critique of Marx. This morning, I want to be sure to present Bohm Bawerk's critique of Marx. Let me say a couple of words in terms of historical reference points. Adam Smith published The Wealth of Nations in 1776. The last edition of David Ricardo's Principles of Political Economy and Taxation appeared in 1823. Marx published Volume 1 of Das Kapital in 1867. The last prominent classical economist was John Stuart Mill. I believe the last edition of his book, Principles of Political Economy, appeared in 1870 or 71, sometime early in the 70s. Classical economics died out by the mid-70s, largely because it was taken for granted that the logical ending point of classical economics was Marxism. The Austrian school and other branches of neoclassical economics are generally dated from 1871. Bohm Bawerk is the second figure in terms of time in the Austrian school. Karl Menger was the first. Menger published his Principles of Economics in 1871. The first edition of Bohm Bawerk's Capital and Interest, I believe, appeared in 1886, but I might be off by a few years. The material that I'm going to present to you today on Bohm Bawerk can be found in Volume 1 of Capital and Interest, titled History and Critique of Interest Theories, and also in a separate essay written by Bohm Bawerk, usually called Towards the Close of the Marxian System, but properly translated as Toward the Completion of the Marxian System. It can be purchased under the title Toward the Close of the Marxian System from Augustus Kelly, Reprints of Economic Classics, or you can read it in Shorter Classics of Bohm Bawerk, published by Libertarian Press, who also publishes Capital and Interest. Correction, the exact English language title of the translation of Bohm Bawerk's essay is Karl Marx and the Close of His System. In the Libertarian Press edition of Shorter Classics of Bohm Bawerk, that essay carries the title Unresolved Contradiction in the Marxian Economic System. And they date from the 1950s, before the corruption of the term libertarian. All right, well, what is Bohm Bawerk's critique? There are a number of points to it. He points out there are many cases in which the quantity of labor... let me say this first. His critique focuses on the labor theory of value as it applies to the prices of products. Bombaver does not attempt to challenge the framework of the exploitation theory, the notion that all income is originally and rightfully wages and that profits are a deduction. In fact, he works within that framework. He will, as we see, we'll see, ends up trying to show that profits are a justified deduction from wages. He views profit and interest as being a deduction from wages, just as Smith and Marx, but he advances some very ingenious arguments to show that they are a justified deduction. He doesn't deal directly with the iron law of wages, the notion that the capitalist can arbitrarily set wages at subsistence. The whole focus of his critique, as I say, goes against the labor theory of value as applied to commodities. All right, well, he observes that there are many, many goods to which the labor theory of value cannot begin to apply, and goods such as rare books and coins and so forth, anything whose supply can no longer be increased. And the principle was stated already by Ricardo in the practically the opening passage of his chapter on value. And he said, I'm now quoting Ricardo, "There are some commodities the value of which is determined by their scarcity alone. No labor can increase the quantity of such goods, and therefore their value cannot be lowered by an increased supply. Some rare statues and pictures, scarce books and coins, wines of a peculiar quality which can be made only from grapes grown on a particular soil of which there is a very limited quantity, all are of this description. Their value is wholly independent of the quantity of labor originally necessary to produce them, and varies with the varying wealth and inclinations of those who are desirous to possess them." Well, Bombaver expands that list. Ricardo should have too. Anything can be in that category, at least temporarily, if we have a demand that outruns the ability to produce from existing facilities. The price of anything can be determined simply on the basis of its own scarcity. And these are certainly deviations from cost of production or quantity of labor. And as I pointed out last time, he showed how Marx equivocated in connection with skilled labor. How is it that the product of 5 hours of watchmaker's labor will produce a product that might exchange for 50 or 100 hours of ordinary of the product of ordinary common labor? And Marx equivocated, saying we count the skilled labor as so many hours of unskilled labor, and Bombaver certainly got him on that. Now, a more important consideration is the what you can call the profit time factor in the determination of prices, the profit time factor. And here again, I want to point out, this is a question which was seen very fully by Ricardo, and in many ways, more fully elaborated by Ricardo than any of the later so-called Austrian economists. Let me give you some of Ricardo's examples, and then we'll go into Bombaver's critique. We can have two goods, both of which are produced by the same quantity of labor, only the labor is employed with a different time interval between its performance and the sale of the product. So let's imagine that we spend $1,000 in employing labor. We spend $1,000 for wages. We employ a certain quantity of labor, and it takes 1 year before the product is produced and ready for sale. Let's assume that the rate of profit equals 10%. Can you see this in the back? Okay. Well, now
this commodity will sell for $1,100. But let's suppose that this commodity is a raw material which fresh labor has to be applied to, and we now employ a second $1,000 worth of labor, and this labor works for a year to process this previous product of labor, and after a total lapse of time from the very beginning to the very end, 2 years will have gone by. Well, how much will this commodity have to sell for 1 year from this point? The original outlay is $2,100. The rate of profit is 10%. 2310. The profit will be 210. That's the price, 2310. All right, now suppose we produced another commodity with identically the same quantity of labor. We spent 2,000 for wages, but the product, the finished product, was available 1 year later. The rate of profit is 10%. How much would this product have to sell for? 2,200. All right. Are these products of different quantities of labor or the same quantity of labor? The same quantity of labor. What is different? The time factor. More time elapses in the production of the first commodity between the performance of labor and the achievement of the ultimate final product. And Ricardo recognized very clearly that this is a further determinant of the relative value of commodities. And in fact, this is Ricardo's very example. He says, suppose I employ 20 men at an expense of 1,000 pounds for a year in the production of a commodity, and at the end of the year I employ 20 men again for another year at a further expense of 1,000 pounds in finishing or perfecting the same commodity, and that I bring it to market at the end of 2 years. If profits be 10%, my commodity must sell for 2,310 pounds. For I have employed 1,000 pounds of capital for 1 year and 2,100 pounds of capital for 1 year more. Another man employs precisely the same quantity of labor, but he employs it all in the first year. He employs 40 men at an expense of 2,000 pounds, and at the end of the first year, he sells it with a profit of 10%, or for 2,200 pounds. Here, then, are two commodities having precisely the same quantity of labor bestowed on them, one of which sells for 2,310 pounds, the other for 2,200 pounds. Now, this difference becomes more significant the greater the time factor happens to be. Suppose we were producing 8-year-old scotch or 30-year-old oak trees. Let's imagine that we have two commodities, both produced by the same quantity of labor, which we obtain for $1,000. The rate of profit is 10%. In the one case, we're employing workers to put seeds in the ground. The crop will be harvested 1 year later. The product of that labor will be worth $1,100. Now suppose we're employing people to plant oak trees. I don't know the maturation time of oak trees, but imagine it's 30 years. What, in principle, would be the value of the oak trees? It'll be 1.1 to the 30th power. $1,000 times 1.1, the rate of profit will have to compound for 30 years. Now here we have two products of the same quantity of labor. The oak trees will be a major multiple of the value of the 1 year product. If the rate of profit changes, if the rate of profit were to be 5% instead of 10%, there'd be a major effect on the relative value of the commodities. And Ricardo was very, very much aware of this, and he pointed out that insofar as any kind of machinery or fixed and durable facilities enters into production, there's a significant effect on the relative value of the product. Let me give you this example. Imagine we spend $1,000 in wages to workers whose product is a machine. And this machine will last 10 years. It will be used in production for 10 years. Well, let's try to calculate how much value will correspond to the quantity of labor in this instance with a 10% rate of profit. Now, our machine lasts 10 years. That means in each of the 10 years, we have to recover $100 of depreciation. So in each of the 10 years, in the value of whatever it is we're using the machine to produce, we have to get 100 back to cover depreciation. And the average capital outstanding, we have $1,000 invested at the beginning of year one. We recover that fully by the end of year 10. The average capital outstanding is $500. If the rate of profit is 10%, we have to make $50 a year in profit. Well, we have to get $100 each year in depreciation plus $50 a year in profit. What will be the total value that this machine serves to bring in our product over its 10-year use? $1,500. Now notice, here's the same quantity of labor used to produce a machine that contributes over 10 years. The value indirectly attributable to that labor would be $1,500. If the same labor produces a product that's sold in 1 year, the value is only $1,100. Well, Ricardo was very, very much aware of this, and he even applied it in super sophisticated ways. If gold had a different period of production than ordinary commodities, how would that affect the relative structure of prices? He went into questions that contemporary economists, including in the Austrian school, are not even aware of. Let me quote you just a little bit more from Ricardo, from a letter to one of his main popularizers, a good man named John McCulloch, a well-known classical economist of the, between 1820 and 1870. He writes to McCulloch, "Strictly speaking, then, the relative quantities of labor bestowed on commodities regulates their relative value when nothing but labor is bestowed upon them, and that for equal time. When the times are unequal, the relative quantity of labor bestowed on them is still the main ingredient which regulates their relative value, but is not the only ingredient. For besides compensating for the labor, the price of the commodity must also compensate for the length of time that must elapse before it can be brought to market. All the exceptions to the general rule come under this one of time." Now, in fact, there are other exceptions too. But notice, in the same letter, he even went so far as to write, quote, "I sometimes think that if I were to write the chapter on value again, which is in my book, I should acknowledge that the relative value of commodities was regulated by two causes instead of by one. Namely, by the relative quantity of labor necessary to produce the commodities in question, and by the rate of profit for the time that the capital remained dormant and until the commodities were brought to market." Unquote. It's very unfortunate that he didn't write the chapter that way. It might have aborted Marx. All right, well now, von Bawerk's critique of Marx, to a large extent, in my judgment, is really simply naming essential facts already cited by Ricardo. Not completely, he goes somewhat beyond Ricardo, but to a large degree. Now, let's see where von Bawerk nails Marx. I'll give you two separate von Bawerkian critiques. The first one I refer to in the outline as the Pearl case. All right, let us imagine that we have a quantity of genuine pearls worth $995,000. And these pearls are our material of production. We're going to employ labor to polish the pearls, to put holes in them so that we can have a pearl necklace made, whatever. The pearls have a value of $995,000. And we can assume that these pearls are the product of 995,000 hours of labor, if we allow for all of the unsuccessful dives required to find the genuine article. On an average, to get this quantity of pearls required 995,000 hours of labor. That's how many hours of labor are in the pearls. We're assuming that to each hour of labor employed in production, there's a dollar of value in the product, a dollar of product value. All right, let us suppose that we're going to employ 10,000 hours of fresh labor to process the pearls. There'll be 10,000 hours of fresh labor to clean the pearls, drill holes, string them together, whatever. All right, now according to Marx, how much will the pearl necklaces be worth? $1,005,000. $1,005,000. Because all value, according to Marx, is added by fresh labor, whatever value was in the pearls is now in the necklaces. That's it. Labor is the only determinant of value, according to Marx. All right, well, now let's take a contrasting case. Let's suppose we have a very cheap material. Let's say some wood. We have a manufacturer turning out cheap wooden souvenirs. And it's only worth $5,000. It's the product of 5,000 hours of labor. But here we have a labor-intensive process of manufacturing. We're going to add 10,000 hours of fresh labor to this wood material. We're going to apply a lot of fresh labor to processing this wood into whatever our product may be. And again, there's $1 of product value that corresponds to every hour of labor contained in the product. Well, how many hours of labor will be in the product that results from this wood material after it's processed by this labor? There'd be 15,000 hours. Wood product of 15,000 hours . Well, that's worth, according to Marx, $15,000. Now notice, in both cases, what is the value added? $10,000. Now, the labor in both cases is bought at subsistence, and let's assume that subsistence is produced with half a day's labor. So, in order to obtain 10,000 hours of fresh labor, what kind of wage do you have to pay? Only enough to enable the workers to buy $5,000 worth of products. The workers, by consuming $5,000 worth of goods produced in 5,000 hours, have the strength to work 10,000 hours. Well, what will be the wages in both cases? $5,000 will be the wages in both cases. We obtain the fresh labor in both cases for $5,000. All right, in Marx's terms, what would be the variable capital in both cases? It's $5,000. All right. What is the profit in both cases? Isn't the profit, the amount of profit, also $5,000 in both cases? In both cases, there's 10,000 of value added. In both cases, the labor is employed for the same sum of money. There's the same rate of exploitation. In both cases, there's supposed to be $5,000 of profit. Is there anyone to whom this is not clear, that by Marx's logic, there should be 5,000 of profit in both cases. Because in both cases, there's 10,000 hours of fresh labor added, $10,000 of value added, and what do you have to pay for the labor? The same in both cases. Well, if we continue with our previous assumption that we can buy a whole day's labor for half a day's, for the product of half a day's, then the wages paid in both cases are 5,000. Now, it doesn't matter what assumption we made with what part of the working day was necessary labor time. Imagine we had to pay a wage equal to 9 hours of labor. Well, then we'd have to pay 7,500 wages in both cases. The wages in both cases will be the same. The profits in both cases are supposed to be the same. Well, that has a very unfortunate implication for Marx, because what's implied here is, let's observe, what is the total capital that has to be invested in the pearls? The constant capital to buy the material plus the variable capital to pay the wages. What's the total capital investment in the pearls? The total capital investment in the pearls is $1 million. $1 million capital invested in the pearls. $995,000 to buy the raw pearls, $5,000 to pay the wages. What's the total capital invested in the making of the wood product? $10,000. $5,000 for the material, $5,000 for the labor. All right, but in both instances, the amount of profit earned is supposed to be the same, $5,000. Well, I'm going to erase from the top here. The rate of profit on capital invested, which is what all the businessmen and capitalists are interested in, is the amount of profit divided by the amount of capital invested. The rate of profit is the amount of profit divided by the capital invested. Now, in both cases, we supposedly have the same amount of profit. That's an inescapable implication of the notion that fresh labor adds all value and that we buy the labor at its subsistence. All right, well, what rate of profit is made on the investment in the pearls if we have $1 million invested and the profit that we make is $5,000? One half of 1%. On the other hand, what's the rate of profit implied for the wooden product, where we make a 5,000 amount of profit on a $10,000 capital investment? 50%. Now, this is quite a difference. Well, if you read my book, The Government Against the Economy, you know that the first chapter deals with the uniformity of profit principle. And this is not a principle I in any way originated. It was well known to the classical economists. Ricardo has a chapter on it. Adam Smith had a chapter on it. And it was realized that this is impossible. It is not possible for the production of something like pearls to permanently yield a lower rate of profit than the production of something like wood. The rates of profit earned in the different branches of industry have no connection with the breakdown of capital as between constant and variable capital. The rate of profit is earned on the whole capital invested. And what would happen if we started with a situation like this, if somehow we began with things working according to Marx's doctrine, where would businessmen want to invest? In products like this. So capital would be withdrawn from the making of the necklaces, invested in the labor-intensive processes, As capital is withdrawn from the production of things like pearls, what will happen to the supply of pearls and their price? They will go up. What will happen to the rate of profit in the making of pearl necklaces? That'll go up. Meanwhile, capital is pouring into the making of these labor-intensive products. What will happen to their prices and profit rates? They'll be dropping, and the logical stopping point will be when both investments yield the same rate of return. Well, let us assume that the uniform rate of return that we'll end up with is 10%. Now, if we're going to have $1 million invested in making pearls, then to earn a 10% rate of profit, the amount of profit will have to be 100,000. And a 10% rate of profit in this product will require only 1,000 of profit. All right. This principle, the uniformity of profit principle, will govern. But now, what does it mean about value added relative to fresh labor added? How much value is added to the raw pearls by the same quantity of labor here, and how much value is added here? We have 995,000 worth of raw pearls. What are the finished pearls worth? The finished pearls will be worth 1,100,000. All right, we employ the same quantities of labor in two cases. In the case of the pearls, the value addition is 105,000. We go from 995,000 to 1,100,000. In the other case, we go from 10,000 to 11,000.
Correction, 5,000 to 11,000.
There's radically unequal value additions. Now, Bombavik pointed this out, and there are a number of implications that he drew. One was that the labor theory of value has to be dismissed, because we could take a whole series of different cases. The rate of profit will tend to be the same, irrespective of what portion of capital is used to pay wages and what portion is used to buy materials and equipment. The rate of profit will be the same. But the value added will be very, very different. The deviation from what Marx expects the price to be will exist in each case. Marx, in each case, expects that the price will always correspond just to the quantity of labor. But what further element enters into the price? The profit earned on the full capital. Now, Marx ended up having to concede in volume 3 of Das Kapital, which was published after his death. The economic world was waiting. How is Marx going to get out of this situation? He ended up having to say, yes, there is a distinction between values, according to which everything sells strictly on the basis of the labor content, and what he called prices of production. And prices of production follow the principle of covering the rate of profit on the whole capital invested. And he said, yes, I have to admit, in those cases where a large amount of constant capital is employed, the price of the commodity will be greater than the value. Here, the pearl case. The price will be 1,100,000, not 1,005,000. The value is 1,005,000 in his judgment, but the need to cover the rate of profit will put it at 1,100,000. The wood product will sell for 6,000, while according to Marx, its value is 10,000.
Correction, the wood products will sell for 11,000, while according to Marx, their value is 15,000.
So you have to say, yes, prices of production in many cases will be higher and in other cases lower than the true intrinsic labor values. And then he thought he had a way out of this. He said, yes, but if we average all of the deviations, it is still true that commodities exchange in proportion to their labor quantities. Of course, as many cases as they exchange above, there'll be as many as they exchange below. And to which Bombavik answered, yes, and by that principle, commodities exchange according to their weights and specific gravities or anything else. We average the deviations. Well, that was the end of the labor theory of value in economics. The socialist intellectuals who are inclined to socialism and communism nevertheless still read Marx, and so there's always a fresh, large crop of ignoramuses who come up. But now von Bawerk made a further significant argument. He claimed, here we are, in this Pearl case, we have fresh labor employed. Who can claim that the whole $105,000 of value added is due to the labor of these people who are stringing the pearls? Isn't it the case that the great bulk of the profit follows from the fact that there's a heavy investment in the pearls themselves? Von Bawerk argued that profit is earned on the full capital invested, not simply the portion paid in wages. Of the $105,000, of the $100,000 of profit made on the pearls, according to von Bawerk, $99,500 is made on the investment in the raw pearls, $500 is made on the payment of the fresh wages. And he said, on this basis, the far greater part of the profit, all of the profit that's made on the investment in materials and equipment, on no basis can this be construed as an exploitation of labor. The profit is earned on the capital invested. He left the door open a little bit. He said, at most, we might concede possibly the portion of the profit earned on the payment of the wages possibly could represent an exploitation. The 500 out of the 100,000, the 10% on the 5,000 of wage payments. But then he advanced a further, more elaborate argument in Volume 1 of Capital and Interest, attempting to show that no part of profit or interest was in fact exploitation. And he gives what I consider a very ingenious example, which I'll present to you. He imagines that we have five workers producing a product, an engine. And the total period of time required to produce this engine from scratch is 5 years. The first worker, he imagines, works for a year making tools which will be used in the mining of iron ore. That's what worker one does. Worker two then picks up these tools and works a second year in the actual mining of the ore. Then worker three comes along, has the ore, and he spends year three in this process smelting the ore into steel. Worker four begins with the steel and fabricates the steel into various component parts. And finally, worker five assembles the different parts into the finished engine. So we've got five workers with a total time span of 5 years. And the finished engine will have a selling price of $5,500. And now von Bawerk says, let us assume that we've got five workers who are doing this. There's no capitalist present. There's no businessman present. We just have five workers. And they are cooperatively undertaking the building of this engine. And he says, keep in mind, worker one works a year, and then from the time he finishes work to the time the engine is sold, 4 years will have to elapse. Worker two works a year. From the time he finishes his work, 3 years have to elapse. Then two, one, etc. Let's just write this first worker. Works a year and has to wait 4 years until the product is complete. The second worker works a year. He only has to wait 3 years. I won't bother writing ditto marks. The last worker who works, the fifth worker, The fifth worker, when he finishes his work, the product as a whole is finished. All right, here we are. The product is going to be sold for $5,500. Bombavik asks, would these five workers, without any capitalist around to exploit them, how would they divide up the value of the product? They'll each do an equal amount of labor. We'll assume their level of skill is the same. So we've got five workers, each doing the same quantity of labor of the same degree of skill. Bombavik asks, would the principles of justice lead these workers each to take $1,100 of the value of the finished product? Would they each take one-fifth of the value of the product? And he argues that that would be a very unjust arrangement, and he would expect the workers themselves not to agree to such an arrangement. He says, look at the position of worker one under that arrangement. If he's going to get $1,100, well, he does his work, and then he has to wait 4 years before he can be paid. Worker number five does his work, doesn't have to wait at all after he finishes his work, and he's paid the same amount. Bombavik says, just remuneration of the different workers would require an unequal division of the product. The worker who has to wait the longest should get more than the worker who doesn't wait at all. And he imagines that the way the workers themselves would divide things up is the first worker would receive $1,200, the second worker $1,150, the third worker $1,100, the fourth worker $1,050, the fifth worker $1,000. If you add it all up, it still comes to $5,500. And he says, this is a perfectly just arrangement that the workers would arrive at themselves. And now he says, yes? Until they could work. Well, they could be doing something else, which they get the immediate product of. Yeah, but the point is, between your contribution to this product and your receipt of reward for this work, whatever other work you're doing, the time that goes by between your performance of this work to produce this engine, in one case there's a 4 year lapse, in another 3, 2, 1, 0. There's a different waiting time to get the reward of this product. Well, he argues this would be the arrangement that the workers would make among themselves. Now he introduces a capitalist into the picture, and he says the capitalist will come along and pay each worker immediately upon completion of his work. What would be the just wage that the capitalist should pay each of the five workers immediately upon completion of his work? 1,000. The workers have decided the worker who doesn't have to wait at all only gets 1,000. Now, suppose a capitalist comes in and he says to this worker, look, you have a choice. You can wait 4 years and get 1,200, or you can be paid now. Well, what's a fair price to be paid now? 1,000. You're in the same position as the last worker then. So the capitalist, according to Bombavik, pays the first worker 1,000. The capitalist will then do the waiting. The capitalist advances 1,000 now. The capitalist will have to wait 4 years before he gets the 1,200. In the next year, the capitalist will again advance 1,000 to this worker, and that worker gets paid immediately upon completion of his work. The capitalist will take over his waiting of 3 years, and on and on. So according to Bombavik, the capitalist steps in and pays to each worker a sum immediately upon completion of his work, and saves all of the workers the waiting time. The capitalist buys the worker's claim to the future product in the present, and does so at a discounted value. He saves the worker the waiting time. Each of the workers is put in the position of the last worker. They don't have to wait. This is the principle he assumes the workers themselves would recognize as just. And so here, the capitalist, over a period of 5 years, will have advanced a grand sum of how much in wages? 5,000. And what will he sell the product for? 5,500. And that, according to Bombaverk, is the source of profit interest, buying the workers' claims to a future product, paying them in the present so they don't have to wait for their payment, and in return, the capitalist obtains profit or interest. Now, the basis of Bombaverk, this is an application of Bombaverk's doctrine. A major doctrine held by Bombaverk is the doctrine of time preference, which you may have heard of or may not. According to the theory of time preference, if people value something, they value it more in the present than in the future, or more in the nearer future than in the more remote future. $1,000 now is worth more than $1,000 not to be had for a year, or 5 years, or 10 years. Putting aside inflation, forget about inflation, assume the purchasing power of money is the same, or look at physical goods. Let's say there's something you want. You would like a new car. Well, other things equal, when would you rather have that new car? This year or next year? Or next year or the year after? It has to, other things equal, sooner rather than later. The further away it is, the less valuable it is. And sometimes Bombaverk spoke of future goods undergoing a kind of perspective-like diminution in their value. The further in the future goods were to be obtained, the less was the value we attached to them in the present. In order to make it worthwhile to wait, you had to obtain a larger quantity of future goods. If $1,000 4 years from now is not worth as much as $1,000 now, with the same buying power, then it takes more than $1,000 4 years from now to be worth $1,000 now, $1,200. Well, according to Bombaverk and the whole Austrian theory of interest, the justification is the capitalists are buying from the workers the discounted future products of the workers. The workers, in effect, are viewed as producing an engine or some equivalent, which will not be available until after some time, greater or less, has elapsed. The capitalists step in and pay the workers in the present, and they wait to sell the product in the future, and they're paying in the present a discounted present value. And then they sell the item in the future when the item itself is no longer a future good but has arrived at maturity. That's the basic theory presented by Bombaverk, and you'll find this continued without any significant alteration in von Mises and in Rothbard. Now, are there any problems on simply understanding what is being maintained? All right, what is the problem? How we got 1,200? Well, it could have been 1,225 or 1,175. The principle is, according to Bombaverk, if a worker has to do equal work but wait 4 years, he deserves more than the worker who doesn't wait at all. And so he'll receive more, the other will receive less. Now, we could have had a smaller increment of difference or a larger increment. The specific figure 1,200 is purely for illustration. We need a set of numbers where the one who waits the longest gets the most and the one who waits the least gets the least, and the total should add to 5,500. Yeah?
Everybody was perfectly rational and capable of deferred gratification. Would that mean that the rate of profit is going to zero and nobody would invest in capital, or is this on a basis?
You're saying if everyone were rational, the inference of your question is if everyone were rational, would time preference cease to exist? Everyone can be rational, and certainly they can also have time preference. You must have time preference. The more rational you are, the lower the time preference you'll have, but you will have time preference. Not to have time preference would mean that it wouldn't make any difference to us if we consumed at all in the present. if there was anything we could do which would give us the least bit more in the future, no matter how far in the future, we'd prefer more in the future, however remote, than what we could have in the present. By virtue of being alive and wanting to go on living, we have to consume. In fact, I think that time preference can be validated on the basis of the uninterruptibility of life. If you think about how do we value our life in the present compared to the future? Whatever benefit being alive in the future may be to us, we can't get there unless we're alive today. We have to attach to our life in the present all the importance that we attach to it for its own sake in the present, plus whatever added value we attach to being alive in the future. The present incorporates the future. We're more concerned with the present. If you're not happy right now and you're looking forward to a better time, well, you want to stay alive now to reach that time. You have to value being alive now. There has to be some concentration on the present. But the more rational people are, the more heavily will they be aware of the future. They'll be engaged in they'll be concerned with both. You might decide, I want to make provision for the next 30, 40, or 50 years, but I still want to do something today. And as I increase my wealth and income, I want to live better now, as well as provide more for the next 30, 40, or 50 years. It would not be rational to say, I'm accumulating wealth for the year 3000. That time preference does not contradict rationality. Now, I don't want to throw this open to a general discussion of time preference yet. I just wanted to be sure that you understand what it is Bombavik is maintaining. Now, let me point out what I think a major shortcoming of his doctrine is, and that is that he's conceding a very essential premise. He's still conceding that it's the wage earners who are the fundamental primary producers, and that profits and interest are a deduction from what fundamentally, primarily, belongs to the wage earners. He's saying profits and interest are a justified deduction, but they're still a deduction from what, in his view, is profit and interest, is wages. He's got the primacy of wages doctrine. And Monday, when I advance my own theory of profit, the first application of it will be the a critique of the Smith-Marx framework. Now, I noticed the question from Dr. Binswanger. Yes.
What about the fact in the example of the mother that this would presumably be an ongoing cyclical process?
You're saying if we had this being done repeatedly, the first worker works 4 years. If we do this again and again, in the fourth time he's doing it, he'll now be collecting the income from the first time. Well, there's still that difference. Between each performance of labor and each receipt of income, there's 4 years. The income that he gets today is always the result of the labor he performed 4 years before. He's still at that disadvantage compared with the other workers.
Suppose the capitalist comes in and advances him.
Yeah.
His wages the first time. From then on, for the first four times, from then on, he works a year and gets the wages at the end of the year, $1,000.
Yeah.
Like this opportunity for profit for the capitalist only for 1 4-year period, even if this productive process goes on for 100 cycles.
No, all you have to do is trace through a series of four different operations. In year one, the capitalist pays worker one $1,000 for product one. In year two, he pays worker two of product one $1,000, and worker one will be working on the second engine. So in year two, the capitalist will be paying $2,000 of wages, $1,000 in each of two processes. By the time we get to year four, or year five, he'll be paying $5,000 in wages. We'll have five different processes of production going on side by side. Mrs. Jackson.
That would overlook
the
quality of risk, wouldn't it?
Because
the task force is actually taking over the risk from the worker.
Yeah. Right. And von Bavarck and von Mises and so on would agree that that's a further element, and they are talking about the basic component which they regard as interest. So there would be a further factor where you might have a return above this, and in other cases, a return below it. But the leading principle for what they call interest, and this is how the word profit got to be changed to interest, called originary interest, not just interest on loans, it's still similar to profit, but it's viewed as being earned as the result of paying a discounted present value for claims to future goods. And then you wait, and the future goods mature into present goods, and they have the full value of present goods. Yes?
I'm not clear on how that refutes the labor theory of value.
You're not clear on how this refutes the labor theory of value. The labor theory of value, this is not intended directly as a refutation of the labor theory of value. This is intended as a justification of the deduction of profits and interest. The primary refutation of the labor theory of value was before we got to this. And we would find, you wouldn't be able to distill it out of these particular numbers. You shouldn't expect that each example answers all aspects of every point. This is advanced as an attempt to explain why profit and interest are a justified deduction from wages. The labor theory of value is refuted in pointing out that profit is earned on the full capital invested, not just on the portion paid in wages. Yes, Dr. Hurwitz.
Isn't it true that if you think of this after the labor or after the capital is invested as if the man put his money in the bank and was receiving interest, the 200 representing 4 years' worth of interest and so on, that it becomes more clear in the figuring out how this profit or what this profit is? It's really as if you put his money in the bank.
I think I know what you have in mind. If the workers were to say, well, we want more than 1,000 apiece, von Bavarck would answer, $1,000 is the present value of your work. If you want more than $1,000 apiece, wait for the sale of the product. If you want to wait until the engine is sold, then you can have the $1,200, $1,150, et cetera, et cetera. Or, alternatively, take your $1,000 apiece and put it in the bank for the period of time that would have to go by until the product was sold. So if the worker who's paid after year one, who gets $1,000, if he says, yeah, but I'm really worth $1,200, then von Bavarck would give him an answer, okay, take your $1,000, put it in the bank, let it compound for 4 years, and then presumably you'll have your $1,200. But if you're asking for $1,200 now without the waiting, then you're asking for more than the equivalent of the product you're producing. If you're asking for the full future value of your product in the present, you're asking for more than what your product is actually worth in the present. Yes, Mrs. Speicher.
Isn't the amount of time preference a matter of rational, perhaps external factors such as the amount of economic risk? For instance, interest rates and profit rates tend to be higher in times of inflation. inflation in times of war, whatever?
Inflation is a different influence. Time preference is supposed to be the explanation of the rate of profit apart from inflation. Now, different conditions can influence time preference. Suppose, for example, you have a society of irrational brutes who are rarely on the conceptual level. Well, do they have the means of even being aware of the future? Can they have any realistic conception of what their lives may be like 5, 10, or 20 years from now? If they can't even think about it, how can they take steps to provide for it? If, on the other hand, you have a society in which people act and think on the conceptual level, the future will have a greater degree of present reality. They'll be more concerned with providing for it. Now, what if we have two societies, let's say one of which is very unsafe, like the conditions in the Dark Ages? If you do decide to make provision for the future, well, who knows whether the Vikings will come and plunder you, or the neighboring lord will launch an attack and burn your house and crops, or your lord will steal from you. If you don't have security of property, and you don't have a very great degree of rationality, what can you infer about time preference? It will be very high. People will be concerned with the immediate moment. They won't make much provision for the future. But now, in contrast, imagine you have a society which protects property rights so that if you do make provision for the future, you can count on benefiting from it, and a society in which people do think on the conceptual level, in which conceptually they can be aware of periods later in their life, and they recognize their own self-responsibility and power to effect the future, what will happen to time preference? It'd be much lower. Well, what would happen to time preference as between the Dark Ages and the Renaissance, and then between the Renaissance and the Enlightenment and into the 19th century? There'd be a major reduction in time preference. And this would manifest itself in a much greater concentration on provision for the future. Now, time preference doesn't totally disappear. It never will or can, but it is lower. Now, just what the real connection of time preference to the rate of return is, we haven't shown. I think I can show a connection after I present my own view of what directly determines the rate of profit. But what I've just said now is something to keep in mind. This gentleman straight back here.
How do you apply this theory to products in very short production time or in mass production? Is it still valid?
How would you apply the theory to products with very short production times and you cite mass production? Well, by short production times, if you mean a small quantity of labor, that's a different thing. I don't think there are any products that we have that have short production times in the sense you're using it. Let's take a factory that produces these mass-produced items. How long will the factory be in use? Maybe 50 years? All right, how was the factory produced? The factory was built with machinery, right? And it might have taken a couple of years to construct it. The machinery used to construct it may have been 20 years old at the time it was used to construct it. Where did that machinery come from? From another factory. How old was the factory when the machinery came out of it? You see, in fact, if we think about it, each good has a history, and we could trace the history of each good back to the first caveman. If you think of the fact that tools are used to make tools, and those tools came from tools, there is a very considerable element of time in everything. The question is, how rapidly does it fall off? There's some, to some degree, labor performed at the time of Homer has went into tools to make tools to make tools that have entered into the tools we have. That's a very, very tiny fraction. By the same token, some of our labor will be producing the tools that will enter into the products of the year 10,000. Now, there is a concept that von Bavarck developed called the average period of production. He did not mean to claim that each product, he didn't mean by it that we should say each product has a period of production of 10,000 years, but he was concerned with examining when is the labor performed at the different stages of production, how long a time goes by on an average in producing a product between all of the different steps performed at all the different stages and the achievement of that product. There are some steps in every product that were performed a long, long time ago. An economy with a lower time preference is an economy which devotes a larger proportion of its current effort to provision for the future. If we compare two economies, an economy of people living by hand to mouth, say our caveman ancestors, all of their labor showed up in consumers' goods perhaps within a few days. Their next tools would be new sticks and rocks picked up off the ground. But in a modern economy, if you think of the extent to which we devote labor and existing wealth to producing machines, materials, etc., if we were to ask the question, how long a period of time would go by before, let's say, 90% of the labor performed in the year 1987 had contributed to consumer goods, well, a lot more years would be required than was the case in the year 987. In 987, 90% of the labor performed in the year 987 probably showed up in consumer goods by the year 989. In our economy, 90% of our labor performed today probably will not show up in consumer goods until perhaps the year 2045. That's reflecting a difference in time preference and provision for the future. Yes?
I think I've read somewhere that the average rate of return bears a close relationship to the average rate of productivity growth. If that's true, would that imply that since the time preference is related to the rate of return, that time preference is related to what objectively, how effective technology, the application of technology in capital formation is to increasing production?
The lower is the time preference, the greater will be the ability to adopt technological advances and step up production. But you're raising some complex points which I don't think should be answered at this time, possibly Wednesday or next week in the regular sessions. Dr. Binswanger again.
You have in the example of no capital because they make their own goods, right?
Mm-hmm.
They start mining, so we get around the problem of investment in capital, that, or at least we seem to at some degree, but who pays for the consumption of the workers while during the year each one works, we're getting the wages?
These workers are working and producing products. How would they live? They would have had to first save up what von Bavarck would call capital. In this case, the workers would have to have their own savings to maintain them in the period in which they were working and before they were paid. Yes.
All right, well,
we have a few minutes left. Let me... Yes?
Von Bavarck said that that you have to take into account when you're calculating profits the full cost of capital as well as labor wages. How can you say that, I can see in this example, but in the other example, he sort of refutes the fact that wages are the concept of the primacy of wages.
Now, he's not refuting the primacy of wages, and he doesn't say the cost of capital is deducted from profits. He's viewing profit as mainly interest. He's saying that he's trying to explain interest and profit together. And he's saying that profit and interest are a deduction from what belongs originally to the wage earners. Originally, we have five workers. If they're working on their own, how much do the workers receive?
I'm talking about the example of deferrals. Where
yeah.
Deferrals change the profitability.
Yes.
The excess wages couldn't account for that. You'd have to take into account the capital in order to understand the profit.
Yes, he's saying in the Pearl example, the profit is earned on the full capital invested. Yes. And I introduced the locomotive example by saying, yes, that's true. The profit is earned on the investment in the pearls. 99,500 of the 100,000 profit is earned on the investment in the raw pearls. But he leaves the door open. Is the 500 of profit earned on the payment of wages possibly an exploitation? And now the purpose of this example is to show that profit in no sense is an exploitation. But it does claim that profit is a deduction from wages. In the pearl example, what Bombavik would say is, we have finished pearl necklaces worth 1,100,000. He would say, if the workers themselves were cooperating, there are the pearl divers as well as the pearl stringers. And he would then say, the pearl divers would receive a larger share of the value of the pearls than the pearl stringers because they have to wait, apart from the fact that they perform more labor. And he would say, the capitalist earns a profit by saving the waiting time to the pearl divers. If the capitalist wasn't there, then he'd say the pearl divers should collect the 99,500 of profit on the pearls. What I would like, yes?
Since a capitalist could put his money into a risk-free account somewhere, why would he bother to even go through this and pay the workers?
Well, this is circular reasoning, because the only way there exists an account somewhere that pays interest is if there's a process of production which is yielding a rate of return. And this is an attempt to explain the rate of return. You couldn't say, well, here we are, we have an economy in which there are banks where you can put your money and make a profit. What is it that enables the banks to lend the money to get a return? There has to be the return being earned in production. That's what he's trying to explain. All right, well, let me take the remaining few minutes, or at least some of it, to go into this now rather than Monday. Monday, I would like to go directly into a theoretical exposition. I'd like to give you a little bit of autobiographical background on the material I'll be presenting Monday and Tuesday and probably Saturday. I'm not satisfied, obviously, with Bombavik's critique. I think it's very ingenious, but I think we can do better. For a number of years, back when I was a teenager, let me back up still further. I'm still being my teens, just earlier teens. The very first book on economics I ever tried to read was The Wealth of Nations, because I didn't know better. And you see, I was, I guess I got out of the crib being in favor of capitalism, and people would tell me, oh, you sound like Adam Smith. No one has advocated such ideas. And I'd make a note of who I sounded like. And from all I could learn, Adam Smith was the only one who had advocated capitalism. So I thought I should read him. And I was very, very disappointed when I did try to read him, especially because it was the Modern Library edition with a foreword by Max Lerner, who effectively set Smith up as Marx's grandfather. It's like John the Baptist preparing for the coming of Christ. Smith was preparing the ground for Marx. And it's easy to understand how you can reach that conclusion. The third book I read in economics, or tried to read, was Ricardo's Principles. I had gotten a history of economic thought in between. And I concluded also that all of this stuff leads straight to Marx. And I was very, very disappointed. And the first book I read, where I began to see that it looks like there's some good opposition brewing, was two books by W.S. Jevons, a British economist of the 1870s, who independently discovered the principle of marginal utility in opposition to the labor theory of value. And then I happened on von Mises, and I read von Mises' Socialism and some of his other books. And von Mises was way beyond Jevons, and I could see how he fit in the history of economic thought. And by the time I entered college, having read Socialism and other important books of von Mises, I really thought I knew the answer to just about every important question. I didn't have a broad enough view of philosophy, but not totally non-philosophical. Anyway, in college, I was exposed to Samuelson and his brethren, and my confidence on some important points was shaken. And when I finished college, I decided that, and went into graduate school, that I would do my MBA thesis on a topic that required that I just read good people. And so I read Menger and Bohm Bawerk, and I also read the classical economists in real depth. I went back to Smith and Ricardo, and I read John Stuart Mill and J.R. McCulloch and Senior and James Mill. And after you read them in about seven different variants, what they're talking about begins to sink in. And I knew, the title of my master's thesis, by the way, was The Classical Economists and the Austrians on Value and Costs. And I knew I had learned an awful lot reading this material, but if you had asked me at the time just what I had learned, I couldn't tell you. I could feel it percolating. I was intellectually pregnant, now I just look physically pregnant. When Hazlitt's book, The Failure of the New Economics, was published, he had a long quotation from John Stuart Mill on demand for commodities is not demand for labor. And this was something that my reading had overlooked. And in reading this passage, everything started to come together. And I had like a 5-day period of doing nothing but integrating and solving all kinds of accumulated economic problems that had come up. And one of these problems I had had in the 3 or 4 years before, an ongoing debate with Murray Rothbard, who I was attending von Mises' seminar with, on the question of whether or not the rate of profit had to fall. And to me, that seemed like the system extinguishing itself. The argument is the rate of profit has to fall in order to have capital accumulation. And this seemed totally wrong to me in principle, and I was looking for why this did not have to be the case. And another question that I had accumulated along the way, if you've read Human Action and you're familiar with the doctrine of the purchasing power, price premiums and the rate of interest, that if prices are rising, the rate of interest will be that much higher. If they're falling, they'll be that much lower. Well, there was a disturbing problem. What if we had rapid increases in production? And without any fall in prices, let's assume the rate of profit interest would be 5%. What if production were able to increase at 6% a year? Would this mean there'd be a loss rate of 1%? Would economic progress wipe out the rate of profit? That was something that I couldn't philosophically accept. So I had that question, the falling rate of profit question, a variety of other questions. And then as a result of having read The Classical Economists and then seen this quotation by Mill, everything started coming together. And in a relatively brief period of time, I was able to answer a whole slew of questions. And I was immensely satisfied, and I was naive enough to believe that in writing all this out, I used this as my doctoral dissertation. I wrote a doctoral dissertation
called the theory of originary interest, which I would now call profit. It was 640 pages. I handed it in, and I sort of had the expectation, well, I'll be made president of the American Economic Association. And as things turned out, the results were rather different. One member of my committee rejected the dissertation outright. This was someone who later went off to write editorials for the Washington Post. And von Mises sort of found, he said he found the situation amusing in a way, because here was this professor whom he regarded as a Marxist, and at the same time, very regrettably, he regarded my dissertation as, in his words, putting the fundamental ideas behind Marxism on a more modernized scientific basis, because what I was doing, in essence, was going back and finding a great deal of value in the classical economists. And so he tended to think, he said to me he thought that I was implying the labor theory of value, which I certainly don't believe I was. And what I will do on Monday, I hope to be able to present the gist of the first half of my basic theory of profit. And the first application of it will be a critique of the Smith-Marx framework. Let me say also, to those of you who were here last time, if you remember lectures 4 through 6, in my judgment, that's a total refutation of Marx's ideas on the iron law of wages and all of the implications. I think I explain how and why real wages rise, what makes the working day shorten, how child labor was eliminated, and so on. And the theory that I advanced to do that, I didn't stress this at the time, is actually my version of some classical economic ideas, namely the wages fund doctrine and the notion that the demand for labor is separate and distinct from the demand for consumer goods, something we'll go into further on Monday. But if you're interested in the critique of the Marxian wage doctrine, I refer you to that. It's not even necessary for you to buy that set of tapes. If you're enough glutton for punishment, we can arrange for you to hear them free of charge, should you be interested at a time you might want to set up during the period of this conference. All right, so I will be advancing a theory which is different than the Austrian theory. I think it can be reconciled, but I would say that the theory that I will be propounding is closer in spirit to Ricardian classical economics than to the Austrian school, and provides the basis for a much more powerful critique of the exploitation theory. And if we had the time, which I don't know that we will, I could show you how it can be used to rip up Keynes also, and to explain a lot of other important issues as well. Well, I thank you very much. I'll see you on Monday.